Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we look not at sex in the city, but at sex in the heartland, in Kansas, during the 1960s. It was the sexual revolution, or was it? And was it all about sex, or was it concerned with politics and culture? We shall see. And we'll also be taking up the much-debated question, is ours still the framers' constitution, or as it be? Two interesting topics, but before we get to them, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on September 30th, 1946, an international military tribunal in Nuremberg, Germany, found 22 top Nazi leaders guilty of war crimes. The trials began nearly a year earlier, on October 18th, 1945, when the chief prosecutor lodged an indictment with the tribunal charging 24 individuals with a variety of crimes and atrocities, including the deliberate instigation of aggressive wars, extermination of racial and religious groups, murder and mistreatment of prisoners of war, and the murder, mistreatment, and deportation to slave labor of hundreds of thousands of inhabitants of countries occupied by Germany during World War II. By the military tribunal's judgment, 12 of the defendants were found guilty and sentenced to death by hanging. 7 received prison terms ranging from 10 years to life, and 3 were acquitted. Those condemned to death were executed on October 16, 1946. Hermann Göring committed suicide in prison hours before he was to be executed. Another war crimes trial was held under international authority in Tokyo. Of the 28 defendants in that trial, 7 were condemned to death by hanging, and all but 2 of the others were sentenced to life imprisonment.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, one of Germany's last trials for Nazi crimes has ended with the conviction of a 93-year-old former SS officer on 59 counts of murder stemming from a 1944 massacre of Italian resistance fighters. The court also ruled, however, that Friedrich Engel is too old to be imprisoned. Judge Rolf Seedorf said that the evidence showed that Engel, known in Italy as the Butcher of Genoa, played a leading role in organizing the May 19, 1944 shootings in reprisal for an attack on a movie theater that killed 5 German Navy men 4 days earlier. The Italians were bound in groups, marched to the side of a pit, and shot. And the 1945 liberation of the Sachsenhausen concentration camp in Germany did not end its history as a place of misery and death. The Soviets, who came to occupy the area after World War II, turned it into a prison camp. Until the fall of the Iron Curtain, little was known about Sachsenhausen in the post-war period, but its files have been made available to the public and its sordid past revealed. Researchers say that about 12,000 inmates died there between 1945 and 1950, when the prison was finally closed. Mass graves from the Soviet period were discovered in 1990, and now a museum and memorial have been opened on the site, adjacent to but distinct from those already dedicated to the camp's victims of the Nazi era. This is Talking History. Some blame it on the pill, others on the breakdown of traditional values among the nation's youth. The change was so dramatic that it was called the sexual revolution. But just how revolutionary was it, and what brought it about? That's the subject of this week's conversation between Talking History's Fred Nielsen, professor of history at the University of Nebraska, and his guest, Beth Bailey.
The sexual revolution seemed to burst upon America in the 1960s, a sudden rejection of traditional morality by cultural radicals. But according to my guest, Beth Bailey, the profound changes associated with the sexual revolution sometimes came gradually, their roots extending back to the 1940s and 1950s. These transformations were often wrought by ordinary Americans in ordinary places. And while the sexual revolution was certainly about sex, it was often about much more. Beth Bailey is a professor of American Studies at the University of New Mexico and the author of Sex in the Heartland, which focuses on the post-war evolution of sexual attitudes and practices in a single Midwestern city, Lawrence, Kansas. Professor Bailey, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you've written a book about sex in the heartland. Why not sex in the city?
You don't know how many times I've told people that I was working on sex in Kansas and they thought I was telling a joke. That's really why I wanted to write about sex in Kansas instead of sex in the city, because there's a real sense of Kansas as being out of the mainstream. How many times do you hear that phrase, you're not in Kansas anymore? And I picked Kansas because it seemed really to be the opposite of New York. So many people treat it as, in the public imagination, the antithesis of bicoastal sophistication. So my sense was that if I could show the changes that were taking place in Kansas instead of in places like New York and San Francisco, that where there have always been groups that didn't really live in accord with the conventional rules about sex, I could show that there really was more of a revolution. When I was doing the research for this book, I heard a story many times from different people in Lawrence, Kansas, about Ed Sanders, who was one of the real heroes of the counterculture, who lived in New York and was part of the band The Thugs and edited a poetry magazine, I guess, whose name I can't really say on the radio these days still. And he had come to Lawrence because he was interested in the poetry scene and was walking down the street one night and ran into a man there in Lawrence walking down the street completely naked. And the way they tell the story in Lawrence is that Ed Sanders talked to this man in Lawrence for a little while, and then they both went on their way, and Sanders said, "Well, Lordy, the revolution's come, because this is happening in Lawrence, Kansas, and not just in major centers of the country."
Now, Sanders is walking down the streets of Lawrence, Kansas in, what, the late 1960s?
Mid-1960s, yeah.
What kinds of things prepared Lawrence for the revolution that he thought he saw? What had gone on in the 40s and 50s, for example, to pave the way for those changes?
There are really two sets of changes that I'm tracing in the book, and one of them is the more conventional story that we already know. The kinds of things that Alfred Kinsey found in his studies of sexuality in America in the late 1940s and early 1950s, that the ways that people behaved didn't necessarily correspond with the rules that existed in the culture. So when Kinsey was looking at behavior in the U.S. in this period, he discovered that more than 80% of women in his sample disapproved of premarital sex, but more than 50% of them had had premarital sex. He discovered that 30-something percent of American men had had some kind of experience of homosexuality in their lifetime. Now, historians have increasingly found problems with Kinsey's sample, with his methods, with the ways he was conducting his research. But those kinds of issues still really do hold. The way people were behaving across the 20th century didn't necessarily correspond with what they said they did or with what the rules were. And now, that's a part of it, the way in which what he called the overt culture didn't match the covert culture. People were having sex before the sexual revolution in ways they weren't supposed to be doing so. Though what's interesting is that the way a lot of them counted what sex was has a lot to do with the way that President Clinton counted what's real sex and what isn't. It's the kind of tortured definition where the missionary position becomes, in some senses, the final frontier. So one set of changes that was taking place is the way that what people were doing was changing gradually, and that people start to come to terms with that by the 1960s. But the more unusual argument I'm trying to make in this book is that the origins of the sexual revolution in many times lie in places that had really very little to do directly with sex, or certainly weren't intended to enable a revolution in sex. The creation of an interstate highway system, certainly nobody went before Congress and argued that we needed to fund interstate highway system to enable a sexual revolution. But what's happening in the period after World War II is a process of nationalization, where the nation is being tied more closely together. And that means that local elites and local communities in many ways have less control over the boundaries of their community and over what rules and customs prevail in those communities. In Lawrence, for example, right after the war, there was a concerted move by some of the local elites to try and pull the town back into what they saw as proper morality after some of the disruptions of the war. And one of the main things they wanted to do was to shut down the bars that had grown up where you could go and drink and dance, because they thought that having drink and dancing in the same place was an occasion for sexual immorality more often than not. And they had statistics to back them up from all sorts of federal agencies that had studied wartime behavior. So they made an ordinance that said you can't drink and dance in the same place. So all of the patrons said, fine, we'll go to Topeka, we'll go to Kansas City, we'll leave. And the the business people in Lawrence finally forced them to change the law back because it was easier. More people had cars, there were better roads, it was easier to go other places. It was hard to draw the lines around the community. Same thing happened with literature that had to do with sexuality. All sorts of places where the boundaries were more permeable and the control was less complete.
Another change, it's a medical one that occurs in the early 60s, is the introduction of the pill. It's a medical breakthrough. But as you've already mentioned, there were attitudes. I think you quote one survey in your book that 80 or 90% of college students consider premarital sex immoral, which raises the question, notwithstanding the medical breakthrough, what kinds of changes in attitudes were necessary for these unmarried women to want to use the medical breakthrough?
Those statistics are always so complicated because what I found at the University of Kansas in the mid-60s is something around 98% of senior women saying that they disapproved of premarital sex, but it's really, really, really unlikely that 98% of them were virgins at that point, especially because the number of them on the pill, according to the medical statistics, there were was really, really high. So people often, one of the things that happened in the sexual revolution is people starting to admit to what they were actually doing, and it was becoming more acceptable. With the pill, a lot of the works you read about the 60s in general sort of say, and then there was the pill, and it caused the sexual revolution. And it just doesn't work that way because, as it is today, you couldn't get the pill on the free market. It didn't just appear. You had to have it prescribed by a doctor. And throughout the nation, the medical profession was very hesitant to prescribe pills for unmarried women. That right wasn't guaranteed by the Supreme Court until in the 1970s. People certainly did things like buy gold rings at drugstores and get fitted for diaphragms or get the pill, but it wasn't readily available because most physicians, like most Americans, didn't believe that unmarried women had any business having contraceptives. And there was a huge debate about whether making them available to college women would increase promiscuity, as it was put at the time. So there was a dual set of changes. Part of it was young people feeling like they could go and ask for the pill without their reputation being ruined. And part of it was the medical profession being willing to prescribe it. I found a story in Kansas City of a woman going to a doctor there, and before he would give her the pill, he gave her a long lecture about how it would make men think that she was sexually available and told her the story of a woman getting beaten up for not having sex with a man who knew she was on the pill, as if that were one of the medical side effects that one might encounter. The reason the pill became available to unmarried women was really not so much because of concern about protecting them in sex, but because of a concern about the population growth problem. People during this era were immensely concerned in the field of public health about the worldwide population growth. And in the U.S., unfortunately, that was often tied to concerns about the growth of a welfare state and money being paid to unmarried women and their children. And so there was a move within the public health business, the public health field, to make the pill more available as a way of stemming the public health problems of unbridled population growth. And in many ways, unmarried women came in through the side door. In Lawrence, the physician who ran the public health service there was immensely involved in zero population growth and these problems. He thought it was the biggest problem that faced the world. And he was handing out the pill by the armful to young women who came in and telling them to give it to all their friends.
Probably few people today remember Linda LeClaire, but she achieved a kind of national fame, I guess actually infamy is a better word, back in 1968. Could you remind us of who she was?
Sometimes I hate to be contributing to Linda LeClaire's continued infamy because I'm sure she doesn't appreciate it. Linda LeClaire was a young woman who was enrolled at Barnard College in the mid to late 1960s who was living off campus with her boyfriend who was a student at Columbia. And Barnard, like most places in the country, had very strict rules about how young women were supposed to behave themselves and curfews and such. And the way she got away with living off campus was by filling out forms that said she was living as a live-in domestic helper in someone else's home, when in fact that was a friend and she wasn't. She was living with her boyfriend. And she got caught. What happened is that the New York Times decided to do a feature article about the new practice, as they I interviewed some couples around the city, and even though Linda LeClaire used a pseudonym, she used enough of specifics about herself and her school that it was really not so hard for the Barnard administration to figure out who she was, and she got very quickly called on the carpet for this. She got in trouble officially for lying about where she was living rather than for living with a man, but it became a huge issue around the country. And what's really funny about this is that this is the same spring that Columbia was being occupied, that the entire nation was in uproar, and half of the headlines that you found in New York during that spring seemed to be about Linda LeClaire living with a man. She was called horrible things in newspapers around the country. I've been through the Acacia's letters at Barnard, and the word that shows up most really is alley cat. There's a real sense of the fact that she was living with a man. It became a huge, huge national issue, and she was roundly criticized, and calls were flooding in, she should be expelled, etc. What eventually happened is that the Barnard Disciplinary Committee did not expel her, but they barred her from the student cafeteria, which is a kind of perhaps not terrible punishment for those of us who have eaten in college cafeterias in the past, but it reflected that sense, that in some senses, that sexuality is contagious and that young women who are sexually active should be somehow quarantined from other young women because it might spread. But the fact that this could be an amazing struggle and crisis in national culture in 1968, the year that Martin Luther King was assassinated, that Robert Kennedy was assassinated, that there were tanks in the streets of Chicago, tells us something about how sexual culture has changed over these years.
What's the legacy of the sexual revolution after all these years?
I'm more optimistic about the legacy of the sexual revolution than many. And it's not because I think that we're without problems in our sexual lives today. But I look back as a historian, and I see so many tragedies from the previous systems of young women whose lives were ruined in many ways because they transgressed against the sexual norms, women who were considered spoiled, of homosexuality being so much not accepted that young men especially who were discovered in consensual sexual relationships with other men could be put in jail or expelled from school. Not having that happen is an important legacy of the sexual revolution. It's a good legacy. The other thing that I see as important is that we have more debates today about what's appropriate. There are more choices, but we also talk about what works and why. It's possible for young people to decide that they want to remain virgins until marriage. It's possible for young people to live together. It's possible for people to have dates or other kinds of hanging out, hooking up in ways that are more gender equal. That's a good thing. And I think that one of the main legacies of the sexual revolution I see is the ways it's interacted with changes in women's roles. The rules about sex in the previous part of the 20th century were very much a double standard. They were based on the notion that women had to control and limit sex and that men were supposed to be the aggressors. People behaved in different ways, but they all felt the weight of that system of prescriptions and rules. And we still have some double standard today, but it's not nearly as fierce. And there's a great deal more assumption that men and women in heterosexual relationships go into this in a greater position of equality, and that their relationships are based more on gender equality, and that has an effect on the kind of sexual relationships they have as well. Because the sexual revolution wasn't just about who has sex with whom, when, and how often. It was also about the way we organize our long-term relationships and the relationships between men and women in society.
Well, Professor Bailey, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
I've been visiting with Beth Bailey, the author of Sex in the Heartland.
have the last two centuries done to the U.S. Constitution? Is it still the Framers' Constitution, or has it been changed in significant ways, in ways that its authors would see as dramatically altering the institutions they sought to create and the relationship between those institutions and our rights as citizens? That's the subject of this week's commentary by Cass Sunstein, professor of jurisprudence in the University of Chicago Law School.
The United States Constitution was an attempt to create a special and new kind of democracy. Has the country lived up to the framers' goals and aspirations? The best answer is yes, but to understand that answer, we have to look first at the huge changes in our institutions and our rights that have occurred since the founding, and also at recent technological changes that allow information to spread instantly across large distances. The Constitution of the Framers does remain alive and well. The system of checks and balances ensures a measure of reflection and reason-giving in government. Consider recent debates over measures to combat terrorism. The law that eventually was enacted by Congress was much more cautious and effective than the earliest drafts. But in other ways, our Constitution is no longer the Framers' Constitution. With respect to federalism, the 20th century has witnessed a big increase in the power of the national government, the power of the center. The presidency is also far stronger than the framers anticipated, partly because of the growing role of the United States in the world, but partly because of the public demand for strong domestic leadership. The framers would have a hard time recognizing the modern presidency as what they attempted to create. Our rights have changed radically, too, with, for example, much more expansive protections of speech by dissenters and much more expansive protection of criminal defendants than the framers would have anticipated. Race and sex discrimination are, of course, now banned, and that's very recent. The most important of changes within the last 10 years or so have involved technology. Recent technologies, above all the Internet, have made the nation much smaller in a way than it was at the founding. And now we can communicate across geographical distances in ways the framers would have found literally unbelievable. Because of the Internet, political deliberation is much different from what was anticipated, and we now have new and quite wonderful opportunities for political deliberation among people who have very different life experiences. We do have a great deal to celebrate. Many of the goals of the Constitution have been realized. But that success owes a great deal to people who did their work long after the framers lived and died. Our framers include Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Martin Luther King Jr., and Ronald Reagan. Undoubtedly, many more will follow them.
You've been listening to Cass Sunstein, Llewellyn Distinguished Service Professor of Jurisprudence in the University of Chicago Law School and the author of Designing Democracy, What Constitutions Do. This is Talking History. As part of our weekly segment, wherein we recommend to you places of historical interest you might visit in your travels, we call to your attention a new museum located in the nation's capital. Here to tell you about it is Joey Skidmore.
The International Spy Museum opened recently in Washington, D.C., only a few blocks from the headquarters of the FBI. Jonah and Antonio Mendez, husband and wife and both alumni of the CIA, designed the museum with the help of an advisory board drawn from former members of the FBI, CIA, and KGB. The museum contains artifacts drawn from the spy business along with interactive installations and multimedia exhibits. The devices include an overcoat with a camera lens in one of its buttons, tripped with a pocket shutter, a single-shot pistol housed in a lipstick tube, known as the Kiss of Death, an 18th-century code-breaking wheel of the type used by Thomas Jefferson, an exploding tree stump, and an Aston Martin DB5, resembling the car driven by James Bond in Goldfinger, but without a working ejection seat or system to generate smoke. The museum is housed in 5 restored buildings in downtown Washington, one of which once served as the headquarters of the American Communist Party.
And if you decide to visit the International Spy Museum, you might add to your itinerary another spy museum located just beyond the Beltway in Fort Meade, Maryland, the National Cryptologic Museum. You won't find a lipstick pistol or a secret listening device, or even an exploding stump at this museum, but you will find some of the most important tools in the history of espionage, like the machines developed by the Ultra Project, which cracked Enigma, the Germans' secret code during World War II, and Venona, the Army intelligence program used to expose Soviet spies after World War II. The National Cryptologic Museum is pretty traditional fare as compared to the International Spy Museum. It depends on display cases filled with artifacts, and it has no interactive exhibits, but you will get the type on the Enigma Museum, and just so you know, the museum is housed in the headquarters of the National Security Agency. And that's it for another week of Talking History. Hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions, either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu, or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.
I can't forget about last night. With your legs wrapped around me tight. The way your teeth sink in my neck. I'm going down for the final check.